Hi, everybody.
Someone has joined the conference.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us for a very special conference call today. I think from all of us at New York Roadrunners, we certainly welcome all of you, and we consider the coaches, and especially we welcome today Terrence, Brad, and Keith, absolutely the key component in a successful athlete's career. You look at most athletes, and certainly young athletes, there's no more important role than the role of the coach. And I think
someone has joined the conference.
Well beyond looking at individual coaches and individual athletes.
Someone has joined the conference.
Heading into the trials today at New York Roadrunners, we believe that it's really the coaches that are absolutely key to the current rise. They have been instrumental in getting us to where we are today in American distance running. We believe that they are critical and the critical components as we head towards an even more successful successful sport, and especially seeing successful athletes continue to compete on the international stage from the United States. And we're just pleased today to have Terrence and Brad and Keith with us. Terrence has Ryan Hall and Mike McKeeman in the frame. Brad, Jason Ritzenhine, Jason Hartman, James Carney, and Ed Torres.
Someone has joined the conference.
Keith and Kevin Hansen have 13 entrants and have coached at least 20 men in the trials at once, in trials events at one time or another. The 13 entrants are Brian Sell, Quint Farron, Chad Johnson, Mike Morgan, Kyle O'Brien, Luke Humphrey, Patrick Moulton, Marty Rosenhall, Mike Renaud, Trent Briney, Pat Rizzo, Todd Snyder. Keith, help me with Nick's last name.
Arsenaga.
So without further ado, we welcome the coaches and we welcome your questions.
We'll go ahead and just start straight with questions. I'll just go down the line and feel free to ask one, and we'll take one follow-up to start off, and then we'll regroup after that. Larry Rossum.
I'd like to ask each one of them to take a comment. They all know each other and know their styles. How do they coach differently in their minds than the two other colleagues that are on the phone? Does some focus on strength? Does some put more emphasis on altitude training? Are other guys more interval-oriented based on the number of times that they may get a guy on the track in a week or do fartlek type workouts?
This is Terrence Mann. I guess I'll start off the ballpark. We're definitely, you know, an altitude training group, and, you know, Brad has obviously been up in Boulder, but now they're down in Eugene. But for us, we're big
altitude.
Someone
has joined the conference.
You know, one thing as far as track, we don't have a track in Mammoth, so that's kind of out, and we're makeshift a little bit on what we do on that side of it. But, you know, I think we have a lot of similarities and differences. I know, like, our group meets every day, twice a day, except Sunday, where they meet once. So it's definitely a pretty intense environment. None of the athletes we have any jobs other than, you know, the job of running. So I know that's a little different than, like, Keith and Kevin. You know, but other than that, I wouldn't peg Whole Earth as a strength-based program or a speed-based program, because we definitely coach individually, and it's just a matter of fitting the individual needs of what that athlete needs at the time.
Someone has joined the conference.
Keith, do you want to take a shot at it?
Absolutely. You know, certainly, you know, we are a very large group, and it's been a big, huge component of our group is working, having that support group. And certainly some of the athletes that are, obviously Brian Sell's gotten more attention than others going into the trials because of his latest accomplishments, but certainly Brian Sell wouldn't be where he's at without other athletes like Nick Arsenaga and Clint Vierman and Chad Johnson and so on and so forth, that every single athlete in the program is what makes each athlete better. And that's been a huge component to our program. And as Terrence noted, our athletes do work about 20 to 25 hours a week, which I find within our group to be a good diversion to get them kind of away from the thought of running 24/7, even though that is what their lives are all about right now. So it's a real fun group, and they work real hard. We don't train at altitude. Much like the Greater Boston Track Club, it had tremendous success. They were also a sea level group, and that worked well for us.
How often, Keith, might you get on the track, or is your group more strength? I know some of the guys like Brian do lots of miles.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's some great variation, and I agree with what Terrence said that, you know, not every athlete does the same thing. Most of our athletes tend to be more strength-oriented athletes. We do certainly recruit a certain type of athlete into the program, or actually take a certain type of athlete, generally an athlete that doesn't tend to be track oriented, so we don't, we do some things on the track, but they're at pretty slow paces compared to, what the track athletes will do. But most of our stuff is, we spend a lot of time on what we call our New York City Central Park simulator course this time, and getting ready for the exact conditions that we feel we'll be facing at the trials. So again, a lot of longer interval pipe work, and occasionally a track workout thrown in there, but not a lot of track emphasis.
Brad, do you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I'll say that I coach four individuals, even though my group is called the Boulder Performance Group. I coach four individuals, and this time around I had two athletes at sea level, Jason Ritzenhine and Jason Hartman, and I had two athletes at altitude, James Carney and Ed Torres, who are now at sea level. Ed is in Chicago, and James is in State College, Pennsylvania. And I coach them all very differently. We don't train the same each cycle. It changes a little bit. We keep trying to do things better. I would say that I wouldn't say that we're either speed or strength. We try to utilize what is going to work best for each individual athlete.
Thank you. Let's move on to John Meyer.
Hi, guys. My question relates to altitude. It's obviously a topic that we've been talking about for decades, but I'm wondering what your current thinking is. I know, for example, Coach Vigil would say 7,000 feet or something near 7,000 feet is ideal. And you've got Mammoth, you've got Boulder, and now Brad has decided that it's in the best interest of a couple of his athletes to spend more time at sea level. Could you all just kind of outline your philosophy of where altitude fits in to the training of a marathoner or, for that matter, a 10,000-meter runner?
Okay. Can I go first?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. So I guess because I have a group right now that I have two athletes at altitude and two athletes at sea level, just want to emphasize that we believe strongly in altitude training. Some athletes, do a little bit better at altitude than others. The real reason that we're using Eugene and sea level right now is because of the soft surfaces. And the last month of training, all my athletes are at sea level doing more specific work for the marathon. We believe strongly in altitude, and we think Boulder is a great place for training. We actually think it's a little bit harder. It's 5,200 feet or whatever, 5,300, and we actually think it's the stress and the times are a little bit slower than that. So I don't necessarily believe in any sort of magic altitude. I just think we use altitude now as a stimulus change. In the past, we used sea level. I just think that altitude and sea level both work very well. You know, a lot of athletes don't use altitude. It's just how you use it in training and how you prepare specifically for a race. At the end of the day, the races are at sea level, and so I think using sea level in our training takes a little bit of the mystery out of how we're going to do in the race. We know where we're going, especially close to the race.
Terrence?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I think, the mystery with altitude is people get a little too complicated with it. And I think, from what I look at, I consider altitude as a stressor on an athlete's physical training regime. And I don't see it actually that much different than the stressor of, let's say, weight training or running up a hill or doing sprints. And if you look at it like that, you're obviously going to see that different athletes will adapt differently to certain types of stresses on their body. For example, there are certain athletes who get quicker gains in the weight room than another athlete. And the same applies for altitude. And so what we look at as altitude as a stressor component within our system. And so it's going to be different for different types of athletes. One, it's going to vary from year to year, you know, depending on how long an athlete has been at altitude, because they adapt to stresses. So for us, I don't think there's a magic in terms of saying, hey, there's an altitude of 7,000 feet and that's the best altitude, because for a new athlete, you know, maybe 4,000 feet or 5,000 feet is the stress that their body can handle at that time, given all the other stresses that are going on in the training workload, be it volume, speed, intensity, density, so on and so forth. So where altitude comes in and where you just need to pay attention to it is as a stress on that individual system, how does that come into play, and what else needs to fit around that? So for us, you know, if we take someone like a Ryan Hall who's pretty much been at altitude, you know, 6,000 feet or higher since he was a young boy, his adaptation to that stress as such isn't as hard as the next person. So, you know, what we've actually looked at this year for Ryan is we've brought him up to 9,000 feet because we found we weren't getting much of a stress at 8,000 feet, and we're looking to add that tiny bit of stimulus to the system to get, you know, improve its running economy.
Mm-hmm. Keith? Okay.
Sure. I mean, obviously our group trains in the suburbs of Detroit, and we have – I like the training area because it is very soft surfaces. 80% of our mileage is probably done on dirt between trails and dirt roads. Certainly, I agree with parents that, you know, it's obvious that running at altitude is a stressor. And some of our athletes, again, Brian Sell, for example, counters that with running very, very high volume. Brian is a consistent 150-plus mile per week athlete when he's training for a marathon. And that's the sort of thing that gives Brian confidence. And Brian would be a good example of somebody, in my opinion, that would have difficulty at altitude because it would be, in my opinion, somewhat suicidal for him to run his 150 to 160 miles a week at altitude, and obviously an adjusted amount of whatever it may be, 120, 130, would be perhaps that same volume or same stressor, but with him, he gains confidence with mileage. So I certainly don't think that there's any real actually be, in my opinion, a disadvantage with the mentality that Brian has and the strength that he gains from that mentality to put him at altitude. And another thing I think I would like to point out is that, you know, obviously we just had a very big competition in Osaka, and we have another very important competition coming up in Beijing, both at sea level, both with very high humidity. I think being acclimated and ready to participate in high humidity environment is every bit as important as anything to run well in those events. And where we're at in Michigan, we have warm, humid summers, and we certainly, humidity is something that we are well adapted to, and that's something that's not easily adaptable to either. So there's many important components to preparing for a big competition, and certainly there's different ways to deal with those components.
Thank you.
All right.
If I could just one quick follow-up just with Terrence. Terrence, I'm not trying to stir it up here, but do you disagree slightly with Coach Vigil then? I mean, it sounded like maybe in some ways you disagree with his philosophy.
No, not at all. I mean, what you have to understand where Coach Vigil's coming from is, you know, he grew up, you know, at altitude, and he coached in a college system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at Adams State, you know, he's at a school that's at 7,000 feet, you know, plus or minus. So pretty much everyone has to buy into that system because, you know, you can't move college kids up and down. So that was in the philosophy and methodology that was formed from that because, you know, he then had kids for 4 years who went, you know, gradually adapted to that stress and saw gains over those 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, you know, when you're dealing with college teams of 30, 40, 50 people, you know, you can't move people up and down and allow them to adapt at their own rate. So all that we're doing now is just because we're dealing with such a small group, we have a little more flexibility to deal with that change. at the end of the day, we're continuing to push people up at higher and higher levels. You know, like my wife, Jen Rhimes, would be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've lifted the blood work testing that has shown that we've got to bring her up to higher altitudes to get a stimulus that she's not getting anymore doing some of the speed work at lower levels.
Well, thank you.
Real quick interjection. If you join the call a little bit later, can you just let me know who you are and have a cool something?
Eric, Dick Patrick from USA Today.
Oh, hi, Dick.
Andy Kerfoot, Runner's World.
Bonnie Ford from ESPN.com.
Dave Hunt Grady at WCSN.
Larry Todd from Reuters.
Jeff
right.
Adams, African Runner.
Great, thanks. Let's go to Joanne Barnes.
Yeah, I have a quick question for Mary and then a follow-up. Mary, do you have any pre-race, I guess, crowd estimates, you know, beyond the grandstand seating?
Hi, Joanne. We expect to have the course, the five-mile loop, full of people, and I'm guessing that's a couple hundred thousand people. Certainly, I can tell you the buzz in New York is sky high, and everybody's eagerly anticipating our top American men coming in for the trials as part of what is, and you've heard me say, the biggest weekend marathon running's ever seen.
And also, with that question, Mary, the grandstands, I mean, they seat a total of how many?
They seat about 4,000 in total.
And just a quick follow for the coaches. If you can talk a little bit, each of you briefly, I guess, on the advantages or disadvantages of having the race on a loop-style, you know, course. Obviously, it has a lot of hills. And do you think that the course, as it, I guess, presently sets up, favors any particular runners?
Someone start?
Anybody, yeah.
Keith, you want to start with that one?
Sure, Joanne. I love having a loop course like that as a coach, and the athletes are fine with it. They're so focused on the event and running what they need to run in that event that, you know, often, you know, regular marathon folks will ask me, you know, isn't that boring for them? It's like, well, they're so, that's all, you know, they're so focused on that. And obviously, as a coach and spectators as well, it makes it very spectator friendly. You can get out there and can run back and forth. You can see them two times a loop, and it's certainly nice and makes it easy to spectate and watch the event. As far as the course, there's some rolling terrain in the course, and obviously we've seen some faster runs in everything up to the half marathon distance on this course. So I think that the course can run fairly fast. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a fast course, but it's certainly, you know, using different muscle groups with the ups and downs in the hills can sometimes be advantageous in the marathon. And so I think that, I like the course a lot. And, you know, as far as favoring any individuals or that, I mean, everybody knows what the course is, and I'm sure everybody's adapted their training to prepare for the course. So I don't necessarily think that it favors anybody.
Brad, you want to take next?
First off, I'd like to say that having a loop course that's spectator-friendly that's in New York City the day before the New York City Marathon is kind of what our sport has needed for a very long time. To promote the sport, just the world of marathoning, but also professional athletes, everybody that's running the New York City Marathon will have an opportunity to watch the U.S. Olympic trials. As far as the course, I think there's a lot of action on the course. Essentially, that means that there's always change going on as far as up and down and grades. I think it's going to wear on people. But I think, you know, we've done the best job we can preparing the athletes for the Central Park course, and I think most people do know the course.
Great. Dan?
Yep, sure, yeah. I think the important thing to understand with an Olympic trials race, and, you know, whether these courses are loop courses or traditional marathon courses, is when you have an event that's only going to have maybe 100 or 150 athletes running, it's pretty hard to get, you know, thousands of spectators to line a 26-mile course that's not a loop course. And you know, in some of those past trials, there were a lot of, you know, as a participant myself, you know, there are many dead zones out there in different, you know, cities, and not disrespectful to any of the cities that held them. It's just hard to get that many people out. Whereas, you know, like I was at the women's trials last year, or last time in St. Louis, and it was great to be able to have that many people out where they're only having to fill a 4 or 5 mile loop, you know, so you're not required as many spectators to keep it exciting for the athletes as they're going. You know, like both Brad and Keith said, you know, the ability for coaches to be able to get on multiple spots on the course, I think, is very helpful for all the athletes. I don't think it's boring at all. And, you know, the big thing I like about this course as a loop course in the fact that it's a difficult course as opposed to, let's say, the regular New York City Marathon course, is these kids will be able to monitor what their loop splits are as a whole and kind of get out of the mentality of just paying attention to 1 mile versus the next. So it'll give them some good barometer checks along the way to see how they're doing. Whereas, you know, let's say a typical New York City Marathon course, you don't know how much effort to put forth going over that 59th Street Bridge because you're not going to come at it again. And so these kids will kind of like go through a learning curve as they go each loop around the course, and I think that's very advantageous.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Let's jump to Dick Patrick.
Question again for all three. A lot of people think that the talent at these trials is the best in the U.S. since the days of Rogers and Shorter in the mid-70s, and I just wondered if each could comment on the enclave effect on that, and have your training centers and others similar to yours been a key ingredient in upgrading the depth of American marathon?
You know, I'll comment first on that, Dick. This is Keith Hansen. I certainly would say I would go so far as to argue that it's the deepest ever, not just since the 70s and 80s. I can't think of another time where we've had all three marathon athletes coming back and running, and then we add to that field a Khalid Kanucci, who's the American record holder as well as former world record holder in the event. And then you add an Abdi Abrahaman, who has run under 2:09 in the event, and you add a Ryan Hall, who's run under 2:09 in the event, and let's not forget Mbarak Hussein, who's also run under 2:09 in the event, that weren't in that field last time, and that's not even including Brian Sell and Dathan Ertzenhain. So I think certainly across 8 or so, it's deeper than it's ever been. And obviously, somebody who is started a group in 99, I felt that was a huge component, the group training mindset and aspect to developing, you know, those a large group of 215, 214 guys that would push the guys that were running, you know, in the past that can run 212 and 13 and be dominant marathoners in the United States, that no longer can that be dominant in the United States because there's a large group that can do that and that, again, pushes the guys that are running 210 and so on and so forth. And I really think that's how development needs to take place. And I think that this has occurred when five individuals, they've gone out and done this and gone outside of the organization, outside of the federation that had been inept at doing that.
Someone has joined the conference.
And so I think that those things have been a big impact in increasing American distance running is private groups and individuals that have gone out and done it themselves and stopped looking to our organization to do that.
Hello?
Yeah, this is Terrence. I would agree with Keith, you know, in terms of, you know, how things have spawned. And I think it was just, you know, maybe the better question should be what happened in the 80s and 90s, you know, where all these great track clubs fell apart. You know, Nike Boston, Greater Boston Track Club, Florida Track Club, Athletics West. You know, you had so many great groups where systems were working and producing, you know, great American distance runners. And then all of a sudden everything just fell apart, you know, late 80s through the 90s until, like you said, Keith's group started up, our group started up in, you know, after 2000. And, you know, maybe it was just people looking back and seeing what worked in the past and then realizing, hey, you know, this is a no-brainer. We just got to put people together and let them work hard every day. And, and then success breeds success. You know, you look at, you know, the success of Dean and Meb, obviously, at the Olympics, and how much that has opened the eyes of you know, the high schoolers who were Dathan and Ryan, and being able to see that there is a possibility for them in the future. It's just going to take work.
Great, Brad?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, just kind of concur with her saying, I think that the trials field is very not only strong up front with a lot of young athletes, but also the veteran athletes that have had great careers and have Olympic medals. But there's a lot of depth, and I think that's important to the sport. Not only are we top heavy right now, but we have a lot of depth. And I think not since maybe 1980 when Sandoval won the trials and we had all those guys run 210 in Buffalo, the trial, you know, this is very, very, probably a little bit better. And I think it is coming from the training groups that are, you know, athletes are seeing other athletes do well in the U.S. Matt Kegenkamp running well, Jason Rissenhine, Brian Sell, Meb, Ryan Hall. I think that the younger athletes are training harder. Some of that has to do with the internet, I think, seeing what people are doing. But there's a lot of depth. There's a lot of success. And I think you look at some of the countries that were great, like England, a lot of it had to do with their club system. And now that the club system has basically fallen apart, they don't have the same depth that they've had in the past. And I think that that's kind of, you know, the Hansen's group starting and athletes playing together in Boulder. I think that when you gain it, it's changing the sport, looking at the past to make it better perhaps in the future.
Yeah, and this is Terrence. If I could just add a little thing, and not to toot our own horn here, but I think what the big thing about these professional groups is now you actually have professional coaches, and you're not having college coaches continue to coach kids who maybe need more attention than they would get, you know, once they're out of the college system, or the college coaches are just overwhelmed with work. You're actually having coaches whose job it is to take care of these professional athletes. And I think, you know, you're able to you know, cut short injuries that would take a long time to heal or just give a little extra care for these guys that, you know, that they didn't see maybe back in the 90s.
Especially in the marathon where, you know, it's not a college event except in, I think, NAIA or something. You know, the fact that it's a much, you know, it's a different level of training and a different level of commitment outside of college running.
Going to the college thing, too, and I agree with both of them, that the college coaches in the past have taken on the athletes as a responsibility because they feel an obligation to the individual athletes. However, the seasons are entirely different. In addition to the events being different, the seasons are entirely different. And I think that, you know, it's often tempting for a coach to throw an athlete into a workout that maybe would help his current team that maybe, you know, in their minds wouldn't necessarily be bad for the athlete, but, you know, these athletes are trying to get ready at different times, and it really is just very difficult for a coach, maybe coach a college team, to really put the emphasis on coaching these post-collegiate runners that are around.
All right, thanks. Larry, fine.
I'll pass at the moment. Go ahead.
All right. Bonnie Ford.
Hi. Keith, actually, as an aside, I'm wondering if your Central Park simulator includes horn and siren sounds and the other ambient noise in New York to keep what used to that.
Well, we certainly have run enough on the Central Park course to know what to expect out in Central Park and all the things around there. So it's a little quieter in Stony Creek Metro Park here in Michigan, but it certainly matches the terrain.
In all seriousness, for all three coaches again, I know there's been over the years also debate about how far out to put the Olympic trials. And I wondered what, if any of you have the good fortune to have one of your athletes make the team, what would they be competing in, if anything, between now and, or between the trials and the Olympics? Would they be running another marathon or a 10,000 or just training or what? What would be your recommendations for them?
Terrence, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I think that's going to be a good problem to have, you know, on November 5th. But I think what we'll look at that point is just trying to work backwards from the Olympics and figure out things like what Keith was talking about with heat and humidity training and different things like that. And as far as race plans go, it's just going to be, you know, putting things together as we see
you know, fit in terms of where the athlete is and, you know, what things, you know, we need to work on. We tend to be like, once we will come out of a marathon or a major championship race or anything like that, take a step back after, you know, the racing's done and they're recovering and look at, you know, what's then the next area we need to improve on and then, you know, start building a plan, you know, from that standpoint of improving that skill set, you know, for example. And whether that means, you know, putting them on the track or running on the roads, you know, more than likely they, you know, an athlete won't run another marathon, but, you know, you can't count it out.
Brad?
Yeah, some of that will depend on the recovery. But two of my athletes are fortunate enough to have the 8th standard in the 10K, James Carney, and Jason doesn't have it, but he has the A in the 5K. But Jason and James, if they made a team, for sure will come back and run on the track. I think if Jason or Ed were fortunate enough to make the team, I think that we would look at another marathon perhaps because they haven't run so many marathons, they would gain a lot more experience. But we'll see how they recover from the race and go from there. But the track trials in Eugene, Oregon are going to be great, and we're very much looking forward to them as well. The fact that New York is in the fall is a bonus. I mean, these athletes have nothing to lose, A, in training for the marathon trials and only preparing them to get stronger for their track season.
I would say that in our group, that the one thing I can assure you is that they will not run another marathon. Whether they focus on the track, cross country, or even roads, and much as Taryn has said, so much focus is on the trials themselves that we would sit down after their recovery from the trials and then decide what area they needed to improve on and what would be the best option. But a marathon is something that in our group wouldn't be one of the options.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
There's also been a lot of discussion about the air quality in Beijing, and I wanted to know from any and all if there is any way to prepare for that, knowing, too, that the Olympic organizers are going to try to make an effort to cut down on that in the weeks, months leading up to the Games. But assuming that it's going to be not as pure as Boulder or Mammoth or even Eugene or even, Detroit, what can you do or not do to try to prepare athletes for that?
I can answer that first. I think it's important not necessarily to train in those conditions, but to have a few competitions in similar conditions. And, you know, after the marathon trials, we'll take a look at what's the closest thing as far as the temperature and the pollution is our athletes going in and seeing if they're going to have any sort of problems breathing and whatnot. But I think that you can't necessarily train in those conditions, but you can see how the athletes react to that stimulus.
Brad? Keith?
That was Brad.
This is Keith. I would say one interesting thing, and you might want to. Dr. Martin has mentioned in the marathon summit prior to Osaka, talked a little bit about the Beijing air quality. They had done some air quality measurements out there, and from my understanding, the measurements that they got out at the starting line for the marathon were actually surprisingly air quality levels that were better than the Los Angeles Olympics air quality. So I think that that's something that should be, I never hear mentioned. If you want to talk to Dr. Martin about that, but I think sometimes it's a little bit exaggerated. I mean, obviously it's bad, or maybe it's underestimated how bad they are in L.A. I don't know which way to look at it, but that's one of the figures I had heard.
Yeah, this is Terrence. Back for the Athens Olympics, you know, we were dealing with this same issue, and we worked with the exercise physiologist at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs named Randy Wilbur. And Randy was, you know, a great resource. He worked, you know, hand-in-hand with Dr. Martin on dealing with some of the pollutants. And some of the other things he did, he would do some asthma and pollutant tests on the athletes who made the team and were going to, you know, head over to Athens to test whether these athletes, you know, were going to be affected more than normal from the poor air quality and things like that. and then started to build some remedies toward that. Like I know Meb tested with some difficulty breathing with some of that, and Dina didn't. And they actually, I think, gave Meb an inhaler for dealing with that for his system, and you know, then he ended up having no problems with it.
Thanks.
Peter Gambaccini.
Yeah, Terrence, you know, Ryan had a different kind of summer than most of the other top competitors. I mean, probably a more low-key summer, maybe, you know, other priorities, you know, which obviously involved Sarah's track career and whatnot. But I'm just wondering, you know, if that was sort of by design, if you decided to maybe give him a little bit of, you know, low-pressure downtime, and if you were sort of confident that when that was over, he would be ready to come back and get in all the work that he needed.
Yes, it actually was done by design. You know, the one thing I learned with Ryan after his half marathon in Houston was his excitability level is very high. And, you know, we actually had a stint after Houston where he overtrained for a bit. And, you know, because of, you know, the success, and then I had to shut him down a little bit prior to London. And so when, you know, when London went well and he was so excited about that, you know, the kid was ready to start training, you know, 3 days after running the race. And so, you know, the advantage of having, you know, Sarah, who's a 1,500-meter runner, have a European season, it gave me the ability to pull Ryan away from thinking about the trials and starting to get ramped up too early. So when we talked about going over to Europe and just following her around and just getting some training in that I could watch over without a lot of stress involved, it gave us more kind of a concentrated window for him to really focus on. And for us, I thought it's really played out well in the fact that it's kept him from being, let's say, overtrained coming into this race.
And, Keith, on sort of the flip side of that, I think Brian, who we talked to this week, sort of, you know, he seems to have been hot for a while now. And it would seem that one of your challenges is to, you know, try and make sure that he doesn't overdo it, and then he can sort of like maintain maybe even the level he's at right now, right?
Well, you know, that's a great point. I mean, certainly Brian is somebody who in the past, you know, we give him 140 mile a week and he's doing 150, 155, and if he's recording it at 150 to 55, it's probably 170 because he underestimates all of his mileage. But the thing with Brian is we've had certainly some long talks because I believe his last two marathons, although good marathons, he was a little tired going into them, and the big key going into this was talking about the fact that he didn't need to change anything, and it would be okay to get up to 155, even near 160 miles, but there was absolutely no need to get any more extreme than that, and his body is now adapted to handling that and not being as fatigued as it was in the past, but you know, I certainly think that he has been a little bit more conservative. Well, he's been running about the same as he has in the past, but my big fear with him was he was going to push it up another notch and, because of the importance of this event. And we've been able to hold him back, and obviously he had some downtime prior to the segment, so it's been, you know, a 12 to 14-week segment, and he's I certainly think he was, you know, he's right at where he wants to be, and certainly has not overdone at this segment at all. He's fairly fresh and running well. Despite having a young child at the house, a whole other talk about additional stressors. There's a whole other one, but no, he's been much more relaxed about that, and as Brian has learned things, he's become even more and more coachable. So things have worked out well this segment.
And Brad, you mentioned at the outset that, you know, each of your, you know, you have like different programs for each of your four guys. Maybe you can just get an idea of like the range of who seems to, you know, require the most work and who seems to maybe possibly be able to get by on the least.
Well, the real difference between last year training for the marathon and this year is that my athletes have trained much, much, much harder. A lot more mileage, up to 140 miles a week. A little bit for Jason, a shorter duration of marathon training. But a little bit, he did a little bit less mileage, but a lot more specific work, a lot harder long runs, a lot more specific 14 to 16 mile runs at 5 minute pace. Stuff that you didn't do the first time around just because it's very difficult to stay healthy your first time. doing that. So the athletes train very differently, but I'll say this, they train very well, very hard, they're very prepared. That goes for James Carney, Ed Torres, Jason, and Jason. But they all took a little bit of a different route coming here.
Okay.
Ernie, Curtis Anderson.
Yeah, Brad.
Hey there, sir.
How you doing? I was wondering if you could speak to how Dathan and Jason have adapted to the transition you guys have made from Boulder to Eugene and some of the specific challenges that you faced in making that move.
Well, the really only challenge, we had trained here before and trained very well, so we knew it wouldn't be that tough of a transition. The real challenge was finding specific marathon courses that simulated Central Park, and we found a place that Athletics West used to use years ago, South Eugene used, called the Rain Highway. That's a rolling course that we do up to 24 miles on that simulates the marathon course. But they were able – the big difference between coming from Boulder to here is the recovery from the training. And training at altitude is great. You get a very quick response, though, from most of the athletes that I've seen when they do the hard marathon training. And so a real long cycle of marathon training at altitude I don't think is optimum, at least for the athletes that I coach currently. And so it has been a challenge, you know, changing it up as far as courses to run. But all my athletes, the altitude-based ones as well, are all at sea level the last month. We found that we can do the way we train. Our marathon training is very periodized, and it gets much harder in the last 6 weeks before the race, and so they're all at sea level training.
How is Jason handling the challenges of being father?
I think Jason is the same as he was before. I think it's an exciting time for him and Kaylin. I think he's always been a family man, and I think it's really no big deal. He was very prepared for that.
All right, thanks.
Go to Brian Gomez.
Yeah, this is for Aaron. So I believe you've seen the women's marathon course in Boston. Can you just compare that to this course, just any similarities and differences, and which you think might be more of a challenge?
Someone has joined the conference.
Yes, I was in Boston last week right after the Tusk race, and Dean and I went over the course with the BAA. It was nice enough to give us an escort and show us around. Loop course, just like New York, it's, the width of the loops are a little different, so it may be harder for people to kind of move around as much. So mostly spectators, I'm going to guess, are going to be kind of just locked in one spot and watching people come around, whereas New York is a little more mobile and kind of cut across the park and see people, maybe twice a loop. I think, and then as far as the degree of difficulty of the course, as far as the terrain standpoint, Boston's flat. There's one little section of hills in the very first 2 miles that's only done on the first loop, and then after that it's just repeated six-mile loops. I think the biggest difference with Boston and New York is that New York you're pretty much enclosed in trees when you're running in Central Park, and in Boston you're going to be actually wide open on the river. So, wind, rain, snow, anything like that, if it does happen to happen at Boston can make it a really difficult course. So I think Boston, just depending on the day you get, could be a really fast course or a really slow, mentally challenging course, and we're just going to have to wait for the day. But as far as preparation, you're just going to have to assume the worst and then hope for the best.
In terms of those sharp turns that are there in Boston, are there any of those at all in on the New York course?
Not unless Mary decided to add some recently.
Fun thing for us was we had quite a challenge because we had a fixed finish point because we wanted very much to finish at a historic marathon finish in Tavern on the Green, and we very much wanted to start at Rockefeller Center so that we could be live on the Today Show. It is extremely difficult with six loops in the middle of your course to come up with a start and finish that doesn't require a hairpin turn, and we're really proud that we were able to achieve that. There is a little on the first loop inside Central Park. We're at a four-mile loop on the 72nd Street transverse. There's a little jog into what we call the Banshell area that's about 72 feet or so, and that's
got a couple turns to it, but it's very gentle, and so we're quite happy with that.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Let's go to Dave and Grady.
Nothing at this point. Actually, there was one. I'm sorry. One quick question. One of the gentlemen referred to an inhaler that Meb used to help him with the conditions in Athens. What was in the inhaler? Do you remember?
Yeah, this is Terrence. I'm not 100% on this, but I believe, you know, what they were looking at, they were just asthma inhalers that they dealt with. And so different asthmas are stressed, you know, for different people in terms of the amount of pollutants in the air. And so I think meth, let's say, in general, has a very low, low grade of exercise-induced asthma. But when you add outside dust and pollutant particles, there's a chance that can get exacerbated when we're dealing with, you know, high levels of stress on the body. And so I think it was just a general asthma, you know, low-grade asthma inhaler.
Terrence, if I may follow up, how much did that help him, do you think?
You know, being, you know, over there in Athens, the air quality was actually quite good. I had the opportunity to be there, like, a couple of days post-Olympics when they, you know, all the factories got back running. And you know, those days were bad post-Olympics, but the days during the Olympics weren't bad. So, if anything, maybe psychological, but I don't think it was actually, you know, required. So, but like Keith said, you know, probably L.A. Olympics are tougher.
Okay, thank you.
Andy, perfect.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I've got one question for each of the three. There are kind of two perspectives on this race. One is that there are only seven or eight guys in it and forget everybody else. And one is that there are a bunch of surprises just waiting to bust through. I'll give you my list of eight. That's Khalid, Ryan, Abdi, Meb, Allen, Brian Sell, Dathan, and I'll add Van Brown. So each of you gets to pick one surprise guy who might be there who wasn't on my list.
Brad, we know yours. Come on.
Yeah, but you only get one, Brad.
I have three, actually.
No, you only get one.
I'll say Charney is running very well right now, and good surprise, but Ed and Jason as well.
obviously, this is Keith, and obviously there's, you know, with a large group out there, there's plenty of people that could step up and surprise, and but I'll stick with Ambie's original question there and let him know that I Mike Renault is somebody, and I put him in there not because there's other people in our group that could, but they would be less of a surprise because people know who they are. But Mike Renault is somebody that started running at the age of 26 and wrestled in college and did not run any organized until the age of 26, and he is very, very ready to go. He only has a 2:17 PR, but he certainly has learned a lot, and I think he could certainly surprise some people.
Ambie, this is Terrence. Can you tell me what that means by surprise? Are you talking someone who...
Yes, good question.
This is top three, top five, or what are we looking at?
Let's say top three. I mean, who could break through into the top three? And then I'd like to go back to Brad and Keith and ask them to name someone who's not in their own group, and the same with you.
I guess if I'm looking at that, I'm going to say there's not going to be a breakthrough in the top three. And, I mean, I guess I can qualify it by just saying the types of runners that are entering this race as compared to the last one, I don't think there are guys who are going to let anyone go, so to speak. So I don't think there's going to be, you know, like Trent or I mean, not Trent, but you're not going to get a Teddy Mitchell who's going to take off for the first half of this race and have guys not go with it. You know, I know the style of, like, Abdi and how Abdi runs, and there's no way he's letting anyone have a minute lead, you know, halfway into a race. And when Abdi goes, Ned's going to go, Ryan's going to go, Brian Sell's going to go, Dan Brown's going to go, so on and so forth. And I think the ball is just going to start rolling from there. And so I think it's going to eliminate anyone, you know, doing kind of a sneak attack in there, at least for the top three spots. I think... You know, if we start dealing with fourth, fifth, sixth, then I think there's going to be a lot of guys who are going to go for broke who are just going to fall apart, and that's where that will come in, but I don't think top three.
Brad and Keith, could you name someone not from your group?
Yeah, I'll say Jason Lemkuhl or Josh Rutinski, NCAA champion in cross country, are two guys that definitely have the tools to surprise. And I think it's going to be a very competitive race for the top three.
So, I mean, that's actually obviously a very hard question. And, you know, what Terrence says, obviously, as far as the top three is certainly, you know, very, very likely and not likely to come outside of that. But certainly I consider, you know, there are going to be people that are going to squeeze into that, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh spots that people aren't expecting. And certainly, I mean, but I don't disagree with that and Jason Lemkuhl, and I hate to say the same person as somebody else, but obviously, you know, Jason has been very, very consistent, just hasn't been able to hit that last mile of a marathon, mile or 2 miles. I mean, he's really been up to 23, 24, and Stadion just has really completely fallen apart the last mile or two. But he, with his Twin Cities run and his run at New Haven, you know, certainly looks very, very good right now. So, I mean, he would be somebody that almost you could throw into the loop of seven or eight people, you know, that would be right up there next, I think.
And Mary, I'll tease our call next week. Josh Rutinski looked mighty impressive on an 18-mile tune-up here on Saturday.
All right. We're getting really close to 3 o'clock, so I'm thinking just maybe we'll spend the next 5 minutes. I'm sorry that I didn't get to everyone. If there are any pressing questions that we didn't cover, if you could just identify yourself and who the question is to, we'll take probably 5 more minutes of questions and then wrap up.
Yeah, this is John Elliott. I just had a question. I know Keith spent a lot of time on the course with all of his runners, and so my question is for Terrence and Brad, just asking how important it is for their runners or for runners in general to have experience on the specific race course that they're going to be running and what they're doing about that.
Yeah, this is Terrence. We went out. We've actually been out on the course twice, or two different trips out to the course. One, you know, back in the wintertime, Ryan was able to do a couple workouts on the course, and then we came back out in the spring and did a couple more runs where we hit it like 3 days in a row. I do think, you know, a course like New York, with the fact that the, you know, learning tangent lines, learning how to run on a course that doesn't have any flat spots is really important. And just to get a feel for it and practice of being able to run an even effort and yet see uneven split, for me, that was a real important one for Ryan to kind of get through his head, because, you know, he was coming off of running courses that were so more metronome style, where you're really plugged into just hitting the same split every time. And for New York, we're trying to learn how to hit the same efforts even, and then, you know, evaluate what the splits would be and just be have him mentally be kind of comfortable with seeing different splits but running an even economy.
Okay, this is Brad. Having grown up back east, I started running the course when I was 10 years old. And so all my athletes have raced well on the course. They're all good cross-country runners. Jason has a course record for the 10K. Jason Hartman's run very well at Healthy Kidney. James has run well in the 8K. And they've all run there. They've all been in New York many times. They've all run on that course. And we have definitely simulated the course the best we can in training.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Ambie. If I could try one more. You know, after lots of years of listening to this stuff, we're at the point in the trials build up where everybody's running 170 miles a week. Everyone's last tempo run was in 47 minutes for 10 miles, and everybody's doing altitude work at 38,000 feet or whatever. And I'm being only a little jokey. What's the most important thing for a coach to do in these last 2 or 3 weeks to make sure the athlete doesn't go over the top? What are you guys doing to have them ready on race day?
This is Keith, Andy. Obviously, that's one of the things we put when we talk to our athletes, one of the things on the schedule right now, and they know basically, you know, tomorrow we actually have a bit of a workout where it's a 2x6 mile. It's kind of a component,
to our marathon training we've always done. It's a workout that they're accustomed to. It's really our last hard workout, and the whole thing is, even this week prior to that, is that, you know, the only thing you can do right now is screw up by doing something too fast. And so really we let them know that they just need to cover the volume, relax, and try not to get out of nervous energy. Don't get out there and run something too fast right now. We're really trying to back off and recover and be ready for the marathon day.
Terrence, do you want to go?
You go ahead.
Okay. Well, the first thing we did differently with James Carney and Ed Torres is they're at sea level for their last 4 weeks. Just A, to freshen up. We found that it just works a lot better when they're getting ready to race a marathon, that they're at sea level, recovering better. The other thing is they only have one more hard workout, so really just monitoring how they're doing their rest and stuff like that, and they'll even take an extra recovery day if we need it as far as how their workouts are planned. But pretty much the main work is over. It's just kind of tuning up a couple little things.
Yeah, Andy, this is Terrence. The first thing I start with is actually putting a check on myself as a coach, because I think that the big thing you got to remember is your athletes are sponges. And, you know, if you've got a good program going, these kids listen and you know, learn to read you as a coach. And if I'm getting too amped up for a race like this, you know, too early into the program, the kid's going to get amped up as well. So the first thing I've looked at, particularly with Ryan, who's a very excitable kid, is I get into kind of like, you know, non-marathon mode. I'm not even paying attention to it that much right in front of him, even though, you know, I'm getting the details oriented, that I'm trying to keep it as low key as possible. And, you know, for the fact that I'm trying not to just, you know, get this, you know, get the ball rolling too fast. So, you know, from my standpoint, I'm really mellow with everything in this last 2 weeks and just, you know, making sure we got our ducks in a row, but really trying to be as, like, nonchalant with it as possible, because then he can kind of feel that same thing and kind of feel the confidence of hey, yeah, you know, we got to go, and we're doing everything right, and we're not just going to get too amped up about it and like he said, run too hard in these last couple workouts before the race.
All right. I think
we'll take one more question. Anyone alarmed from what you've read or heard about the air in Beijing?
This is Terrence. You know, we dealt with the same thing in Athens where that was the big buzzword. You know, I think, you know, understanding the media, you know, we're looking for controversy and exciting things to talk about, and you know, if pollution and heat and humidity weren't that, you know, that big of factors, we wouldn't be talking about them. And so, you know, from this standpoint, you know, we're just going to, like, you know, get to the opportunity to be able to compete in the Olympics, and then we'll start to deal with some of these things. You know, the scientists are already out there doing the work. You know, like I said, Randy Wilbur has already been there in the past couple of years, and he's doing his tests, and he's monitoring different things, and looking at air quality in the morning, in the evening, competition times. So, you know, all these athletes will have their, you know, their ducks in a row, so to speak, to deal with air quality if we have to. But I think it's getting played up a little too much.
I kind of agree. I think the first thing is to get our athletes there with the trials, and then things go overboard a little bit. I think that you want to prepare them for the air, but you also don't want them to be so freaked out about it that that's all they're thinking about. At the end of the day, it's a race.
I would add that the heat and humidity are major factors, but I the air pollution component, I agree, is being hyped up a bit, and I don't think that will be nearly as big of an impact as the heat and humidity will.
Hey, can I throw in on this topic, please? This is John Meyer again.
Sure.
Let's getting away from the altitude, but what about heat? We all remember Dina and Jen and the others wearing the Nike the cool vests in Athens. Seems to me it may have even been hotter for the men's race. Isn't it true that some athletes just run better in hot conditions than others? And And for that matter, is there a risk that you will select an athlete will qualify at the trials in 3 weeks who's not a good hot weather runner and may not perform well in Beijing? I guess I'm asking physiology. Aren't some runners better suited than others to run in extreme heat and humidity?
This is Terrence. I mean, I think that there may be some credence to that physiologically, but, you know, Dina in particular was never a great heat runner. Mm-hmm. But, she had ran, a lot of races where, the heat would bother her pre-Olympics. But I think, what Dr. Martin talked about with us when we had our big marathon summit was, the first priority for every athlete is to get them as extremely fit as possible and then to go in and adapt to the conditions. So, the plan that was for 2004 was to get these athletes in that climate, for 3 to 4 weeks prior to allow them to adapt while they weren't in a heavy training load. And then other than that, then it's just as smart coaches learning to modify what the training program should be for those conditions, even so much as what the warm-up's going to be prior to an event like, a Beijing marathon in hot and humid conditions, mm-hmm. Dealing with hydration factors. I think we're smart enough now with all these ancillary things that, we can make, let's say, not the greatest heat runner a very good heat runner if we're paying attention to the little things.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terrence. Thank you, Terrence and Brad and Keith. And I'm glad you guys are keeping it low-key now because it's going to be plenty amped up when you get here. I thought everyone might enjoy. In addition, this is really an industry and sport gathering. And in addition to all the coaches that will be here and agents and shoe companies and sponsors of all sorts, we have an all-star roster of other athletes coming to watch. So surrounding these guys will be Dina Castor, I certainly hope Jen Rhines, Karen Adam Goucher, Alan Webb, Bernard Legat, Paul Tregat's coming in. Everybody wants to be here this weekend, and these guys will be performing on the biggest stage they ever have. So that's our commitment, and that's what we're working on. And we thank all the media for your commitment. Gentlemen, we especially thank you because it is so key that we provide the media with access to all of you and your athletes so that we really can maximize the stage for these guys as they so deserve. So thanks so much, everybody. We look forward to talking to some of you next week. And obviously, Sarah is here every day, almost 24 hours a day, to serve you as you need. So thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Mary.
Thanks.